weather being slow, unless you want to learn about natural resources, well, the property ones will come up in a minute, one hopes. Let's see. I have, you know, we got a couple outside. I haven't started grading the assignments. I finally finished printing them all out, but we'll get there. We have you have another one due on Monday. I am going to hopefully load this. So I wanted to say that, you know, I really appreciate you guys taking the time to do those surveys last time, and I do read them. And I think I can do. Maybe I can do this from Dropbox. Let's see how. That works. One of the suggestions made, a couple people mentioned that they would like to have a cutoff time for questions. I guess people were asking questions until the last minute for assignment one, and I was I'm happy to have this rule myself, because I was kind of very hurriedly trying to answer these things at night on my phone. People ask to have actually a cutoff time for questions for the assignment. So for the assignment that's due on Monday, I'm going to make Saturday at 5 p.m. the cutoff time. I don't know. Any questions about that? Same thing as before. I haven't gotten any questions about that assignment yet, but it's the same idea as before. Any questions I get, I'll take by email or on Facebook page, and then I'll reply to every, I'll post them both on the Facebook page and on our class website. Yes, yes. Any questions now? Lovely. All right. So I wanted to just point out a couple of things that I learned from the surveys. Very interesting, I thought. Check that out. This is the number of hours spent outside of class each week preparing for this class. That's a quite a range, right? So somebody said they spent only an hour a week, and somebody said they spent up to 22 hours a week. I suggest to you, that those are not numbers that I would recommend. Only 1 hour a week outside of this class. I'm impressed that you can make it through the reading in that fast. I really think that is probably something you need to revisit. Make sure you're spending enough time on your classes. The average was 6, and I think that's about right. There's a rule of thumb. Does anybody know what the rule of thumb is? 2 hours for every, right? So 2 hours for every hour outside of class. So if you're averaging 6, you're below that, right? So and also most people said way less than my other classes, and then a few people said way more than my other classes. So I think that just shows us that there's different kind of topics, subject matters that fit a little bit, that people just appeal to or understand a little bit easier. I would really encourage you to be kind of setting aside time for each of your classes. I did get a lot of people who said that they thought this was too much reading and too many cases each time, but then told me they were only spending 2 hours outside of class to prepare. I'm just not so sympathetic with that. You know, we do have a lot of cases in this class, but you'll notice that some of the cases are like 2 pages. It's just going to be the function of kind of how some of, especially early on in this class, it kind of changes as the cases get longer and we spend more time with each of them. There'll be fewer cases, but the reading is different. Also, people said, I do acknowledge that people said they have more reading for this class than any other class, but you'll also notice that almost all of you agree that this textbook was much easier to read and it flowed a lot better. So I think just counting the page numbers shouldn't make us freak out too much. I know there's a lot of reading for today, but there's almost no reading for next class. It's very short and there's no cases in it, so it will even out. I also made some adjustments to the syllabus and reposted that on the website and on Facebook, which is that I actually realigned the page numbers with the days for what we actually read. So maybe it might help you if you're studying or if you're going over listening to recordings or something later. You can actually figure out what we actually covered because we got offset a little bit. And I had a reading that I had been contemplating, but I wasn't sure I was going to do it. It had been in italics in your syllabus about kind of some of the intricate kind of details that are really really infrequently used, and yet people put in textbooks, and I just didn't feel like it was worth our time. So we're going to skip the little last part of the future interest reading that's about some kind of exceptionally tricky rules. If anybody is really interested in studying the rule against perpetuities or something like that, I'm happy to chat with you about it. I loved the response to the interactive features. Only two people use the interactive features. As most of you know, I do not think they're necessary at all. Maybe they're kind of helpful. If there's helpful pictures, actually, you know that they'll show up in my slides anyways. But what I was a little discouraged by was how many people said they couldn't figure out how to do it or didn't know how. Come on. I mean, I can see, like, I didn't take the time to figure it out, but I think you guys are all super smart people, and figuring out how to use the interactive features shouldn't be too hard. If anyone needs help, I'm happy to help you with it. If you're interested, there are kind of instructions in the book, or instructions if you go to the websites for the book from the publishers. If you want the interactive features and you bought a used book, I think you can pay something like $15 and get the interactive features. You can buy a little interactive license. I don't know how much it costs. Jamie.
Is the interactive features the little blue box that sometimes in our textbook that says, like, click this link to see this.
It's click this link. It's any picture. I think also sometimes you have words in blue or something like that, and it defines them. Any cases or articles that are mentioned, you can link directly through to them. And I think the interactive feature that people like the most is that there are quizzes that you can kind of test your knowledge and stuff for each chapter. I've actually never looked at those quizzes, but that's the one I hear the most praise for. Yeah, this is why I'm saying I don't actually think you need these interactive features. I just think, I was just surprised how many people said they could. It was totally beyond their ability to figure out how to use it. I think that is something you should figure out. Okay, most confusing, people said the hostility and kind of the rules for found property. Some people got more specific. Guess what the average time spent in my office hours is? Zero. I have not seen one of you in my office hours yet this semester. If you do not understand hostility or found property, I recommend coming to my office hours. Right? There's only so much time we can spend going over these concepts in class, especially when we need to move on to the next one. So when I see that so many people are still struggling with something we did 2 weeks ago, I really recommend coming and chatting with me. I've posted my office hours, but I also am like there all the time whenever I'm not teaching one of my other two classes. So come on by. We can talk about it. Figure it all out. Let's see. Here's some of my favorite quotes. We'll share the slides in advance. I just can't do that. There's like answers on them. More hypos, I'll try. Give us rules. Summarize the cases. All right. Yeah, some of that is your job, right? I'm not going to do summaries of the facts on the slide, but I have added a couple more here, with a couple more slides today that have more explicit rules for you to look at. But this is like, you know, one hopes that you can figure these things out from our discussion as opposed to me telling you. Assignment one was too vague. I'll work on that. I have to admit, I work on that every time, and no matter how specific I make an assignment, everybody wants more specific. I don't like the British cases. I don't know. I can't do anything about that. I'm not sure what's wrong with them. We don't have something. What?
Who wrote that?
Who wrote that? Cap's coming after you. Well, okay. I had another class where somebody said I don't like the Florida cases, so I don't even actually understand how this happens. I wish that you sold your mug. I would have gotten you more money. I don't know if you feel up to selling, reselling it. Or have you gotten some personhood? Have you developed an attachment to it? What is it worth to you guys now?
I don't want to be hasty to put a price on it.
Yeah, that's the problem. What happened with me? I just like said $30 without thinking, and they came up and threw it at me.
Yeah.
We'll see. Yeah. They haven't had it that long. Why is it worth so much to you? Why do you care? Is it just because you think you can get more money for it, or do you have some attachment?
Part of the story.
Right? So this is the personhood, right? Like, this is like, it is just a coffee mug. but they have kind of this story, this emotional, this attachment to it, this that makes it worth more to them. And so we can see kind of these personal links to property. I also like the person who's like, I assumed property would be uninteresting. And I cried a little and then was happy. I don't know when I see those things like that. I think this is what made me fall in love. This is the class I took that made me want to become a law professor. I love this class. Today we're going to talk about gifts, though. We're going to talk about gift giving, gift receiving. This is part of your assignment. I know that we had this reading a little bit ago, so we might have to kind of do some reminders of what we're doing. My hope is to make it through all of the gifts by the break, and then after break we'll move on and start talking about estates and land. All right. What are the components for giving a gift? Yes, Deborah.
Intent, delivery, and acceptance.
Exactly. All right. Donative intent, delivery, and acceptance. That is our three prongs of a gift. We need to kind of, and we will see the cases generally focus on whether or not we have each of those things. All right. So let's think a little bit more about each of them. Well, donative intent. What do we mean by donative intent? Yeah, okay, that's very technical sounding. Like, put that in layman's terms. What does it mean, donative intent?
I want to give it to you right away.
I want to give you something. I intend for this to be yours. I intend for it to be a gift. I don't intend to lend it to you. I'm not just showing you something I have. I mean for this to become yours. All right, now delivery. What do we mean by delivery? These are not hard questions. I don't know.
The actual passage of the item.
The actual giving it to them. And I have three words up there.
It could be literally giving it to them, or it could be in a symbolic way, like you're giving someone a car, you're giving them the car key instead of the actual car on top of their head kind of thing.
Yes, okay, so you get the right idea. I just want to make sure we're careful with our words. So actual delivery is just what it sounds like. You are physically giving the thing to the person. Constructive delivery is more about what you were explaining for the car. This is delivering something that enables the donee, the person you gave the gift to get physical possession. A key is the best example here, right? You gave them the key, and that allows them to get into the lockbox, get the car, enter the house. You gave them the code that lets them get into the bank account that opens the lock on the door. All of these things are like you're actually giving them something that enables them to get the gift. That's constructive, right? Like, it's you're giving them something that helps fulfill them actually putting the thing in their hands. Yes. And I just wanted to, be careful. We didn't confuse that with symbolic. What would be an example of a symbolic delivery of a gift?
An example would be, a letter stating.
Great example, right? You could give somebody a letter explaining, I'm giving you this gift. Go pick it up. Here's the details of it. You could explain to them. Anything else? If you wanted to give somebody a gift symbolically. Are you got an example?
Could that qualify as a statue to a city or something like that, or a donation that you make to a city? For example, the Statue of Liberty is a symbolic gift.
No. It's a different idea. So you could have gifts that might have some symbolism to them. But what we're thinking about here is just when delivery is symbolic. Right? Because we need to have donative intent, delivery, and acceptance. And delivery can be physical or it could be kind of this more abstract idea. Peter.
Those big checks.
I think so. Wait, who worked in a bank? Somebody worked in a bank. Somebody who's not here today. I can't remember who worked in a bank. I assume one cannot take those big checks and deliver them. So they're probably symbolic. Anything else you might use? Yeah, Will.
Didn't the book talk about when somebody's handing them the property, they'll
have
a stick or something?
Well, okay, so that is actually kind of an old, that is actually how property used to change hands, and there was a symbol here, I give you a stick or I give you some dirt, and this kind of symbolizes the land.
Picture?
A picture. I do this all the time. because I'm really slow about remembering people's birthday. Like, not that I forget their birthday, but I remember, like, the day before. And so then I give them, like, so I give my brother, like, here's a picture of the thing I ordered for you that will show up in a week, right? Like, a picture of something, a letter about something. Maybe you want to give somebody a car, and you give them, like, a little toy car. And you're like, I'm getting a toy. Here's a toy, right? So you can just picture they are actually kind of they are either physical objects or they can be done through words. You could even do it in an email, like explain to somebody what they are getting. And but this is what we have to remember: this order. There's a reason that it's in that order. You have to do actual delivery if it is possible. So if I have like a sweater right here. And I could actually hand you the sweater. It does not make any sense for me to then instead draw you a little picture of a sweater and hand you the picture of the sweater. Actual delivery would have been possible. I have to use actual delivery. Constructive and symbolic are pretty equivalent. Like you don't have to have like you don't have to like go through the list and be like, okay, can't do actual. Could I do constructive? I can't do. Either one of those are an acceptable option after actual is impossible. You'll see that constructive just doesn't work that often, right? There's only so many places we're giving that involve like giving a key or a code. That's the only place you really have constructive. All right, so yeah, symbolic delivery limited to instances where physical delivery is not practical. Or impossible, even. All right, let's look at these examples then. A father leaves a gold coin on his minor desk, daughter's desk in her room. Is that a gift?
Yeah. I think it's questionable because you don't know if there's the intent there, right? Because he's got on her dress, so you don't know if he meant to actually give it to her.
Right, we got to go through all those things. So donative intent, we don't know. We don't have kind of anything from the circumstance. We could go ask him and see. What about, so this is a little different than our found property. We actually have the people around to ask. What about, but a lot of times we're trying to answer these questions where they're, when they're no longer there. What about delivery? Does that look like delivery? Does it look like actual delivery? I don't know. He didn't actually hand it to her, and he could have. It's a gold coin. He could have walked up to her and handed it to her. I mean, placing it in her room maybe become close, but it's a pretty uncertain thing. Do we have acceptance? Did she accept the gift? We don't have evidence of it. You'll see in our cases, we presume that somebody's going to accept something that's valuable, so we'd have to see some evidence that she rejected it. But we could see how already it sounds, that is the type of thing that if you had just heard about somebody doing, what would you think? If somebody's like, hey, my dad walked into my room and left a gold coin on my dresser, do you think that dad, just without like the law, do you think that dad's giving her a gift or like not? Mostly yes. Anyway, like maybe he just like forgot. Maybe he dropped it there. Maybe he. I think it's the type of circumstance that we think is a gift. It is the type of thing. There's many things that we would say would be like, oh, that sounds like somebody's giving a gift. But if you don't have all three of those requirements firmly met, it's not legally binding. And what we mean by that is that the dad can go in the room and take it back. If it's a gift, if it's a completed gift, it belongs to the daughter. He can't just go in and take it back. If it's an incomplete gift, he can. If it's not... All right, suppose he does this every year on her birthday. Does that change our story?
I mean, I guess I'd say that because it seems like he has more of a donative intent if he's doing that consistently, but you still have the actual component of delivery that's questionable.
So, okay, so there's a case that's kind of similar to this, where a grandfather put, like, he had, like, a chest, and there was, like, a trunk or chest or something, put, like, a gold coin in it every year on the person's birthday. And he said, we can have inferences of donative intent by looking at the context. So once we see, so the first just one coin, it doesn't seem to be done of intent there. But if we see from the context, if the context kind of gives us an idea that this seems to be, it's her birthday, he does it every year, he's never asked her back any other year, this starts to kind of build up a picture that we think that donative intent can be built up by inferences. So I think you're right, we might have a little problem still about delivery, but we have a little bit better idea of donative intent there. All right, now what if the father visits his adult daughter in her home, coin falls out of his pocket, and she calls the next day, she said, "Hey, Dad, I found your coin." He's like, "Ah, you can just keep that." Now what do you think? Eileen, you're shaking your head?
Because originally, she didn't seem like a gift. It was just like...
So initially, it wasn't a gift, right? Initially, this is not a gift. If we just look at it falling out of his pocket, not a gift. No donative intent, not really delivery, all right? So, but what about when he says, "You can keep it"? Did it then become a gift? Yeah, Sam.
I would say yes, because delivery is actual. The keep it is the intent, and the acceptance is her finding, her having.
Yeah, one of the things that this points out to, that this example highlights for us, that might not be clear from the reading, is that they don't have to come in that order. They don't have to be donative intent, delivery, acceptance. In fact, we can think about how crazy, like just how unreasonable it would be if we always required that. It would now mean if the dad really wanted to give her the gold coin, he has to drive back to her house, pick up the coin, and then re-hand it to her. Right? That just doesn't seem to be necessary just to kind of complete the gift. We can say, if he can show that he had the donative intent later, after it was already in her possession, that's okay. We won't kind of require this kind of re-delivery of it. All right, so let's think about this in the context. Oh, here, I want to just make sure we know these three terms. What's an inter vivos gift? Yes, right.
While you're still alive.
While you're still alive. This is most gifts that we are all involved with, right? This is just like regular gift giving, inter vivos gift giving. All right, what's a gift causa mortis? Yes, Martha.
A gift upon your death.
No, not quite.
Oh.
Yeah, Christian.
A gift you make when you think you're about to die.
A gift you make when you think you're about to die. It's a gift in contemplation of death. I think I'm about to die, so I start giving away all my things. And we'll see that there's special rules about that type of gift, the main one being, you can take it back if you don't die. Martha, what's a testamentary gift?
A gift upon your death.
A gift upon your death, something you leave in your will, something that passes after you die. What you're gonna, where you're gonna leave all your stuff, and we'll see that those three things change the rules for how the gift giving occurs. A testamentary gift has to be done with a will, and we won't get into the details of wills. You can take another class for how to write the perfect will, but it has to be meet certain formal requirements of what goes into a will. A gift causa mortis has got this kind of weird kind of conditional rules that you get to take it back, and we'll see also in our reading about gift causa mortis. We'll get to in like 45 minutes. There's certain rules about that. So, but inter vivos gifts given while you're alive, are what form the most of our gifts out there, and what form a lot of the disputes that we're going to read. So those are the rules that are kind of be most important for us. And let's start this by looking at Gruen versus Gruen. Bombard. I'm sorry, I should learn last names, but I don't. Alright, can you help us with this one?
Yeah. Plaintiff, is a dad who died left to make valid gift of title to a kingdom.
Okay, that's very, we got to be very careful about this. Right, so you're right. The dad has this painting. It's this painting, picture of it. When did, you said he left him the painting when he died?
Before he died, he like sent him a letter and said, "You can have this when I die, but I want to keep it until then." And then he got legal advice because he thought that wasn't right for some reason. I forget, he sent him another letter saying he owned it. It's not owned it.
Yeah, all right. So in 1963, and we'll notice this case is in 1986, so it was a while ago. In 1963, when the son, Michael, turned 21, his dad, Victor, writes him a letter. And the letter says, happy birthday. I'm giving you the Klimt for your birthday. However, I would like to keep it hanging in my house forever, until I die, basically. And we have a little bit of dispute about exactly what the letter... He's getting kind of weird legal advice about what exactly this letter should say to his son. But that's the gist of it, right? Happy birthday, the painting is yours, but I'm holding on to it. All right, Mike, now we have to figure out, is that a gift? And if it is, if so, what's it a gift of?
To make a valid intervigo's gift, there must be intent to make a present transfer delivery, either actual or constructive, and such.
Right, so those are the three prongs we just talked about. So let's go through them. Is there donative intent here?
Yes.
Sure sounds like it. Happy birthday, this is yours, right? That is, he intends for... What is he intending for him to have?
The right to have the painting once he dies.
Yes, and I'm glad you phrased it that way. Because notice that what he has is like, we're going to get into this more next class, but he is suggesting that he... There's two things we have to figure out. Is he actually the present owner of this painting? And his dad is just leaving it at his dad's house because he lives in a dorm and that's not a good place to keep a Klimt? Or is his dad giving him a future interest? And we'll study future interest in our next class, but future interest is actually a real interest. It is a real property. I'm not real property in the sense of land, but it is actually something that you could go out and get a loan on. You could, you would report it as being yours. So a future interest means his dad has the property for his life, and then he will get it after his dad dies. He has kind of what we think of as being a future interest in that property. But either one of those scenarios would suggest that he owns something today. Today, the day he turns 21, I believe it's like April 1st, 1963, somewhere around there, he turns 21. On that day, what is he getting? Maybe he's getting the painting, but his dad is becoming his bailee. And we'll watch it for it. Or maybe he's actually getting the future interest. Either way, he's actually getting a property right on that day. We might have a little bit of hesitation trying to figure out exactly what the gift is. Okay, so that's donative intent. What's next?
Delivery.
All right, what about delivery here? Did he hand him the painting?
No, they said delivery must be as perfect as the nature of the property and the circumstances and surroundings. So he doesn't actually have to deliver it to him.
Why not? Remember I just said that you have to do actual delivery unless you can't. Why don't we require actual delivery here in this painting?
Because the son doesn't get the right to it until the father dies.
So two ways to think about it. One is to say what he's giving him is a future interest. So there's no way to actually physically deliver a future interest. It only makes sense to deliver future interest through something that is like a piece of paper like that. If instead you're saying another argument could be that actual delivery wasn't really practicable because you need a painting this valuable, you're not going to put it in a dorm room. You need to put it actually in a place where there's security and meets the insurance codes and stuff like that. So you could actually argue both of these things. But the court characterizes this as a future interest and says, future interest, that's how you deliver future interest, is by describing it in a piece of paper. All right, what about acceptance? Did he actually accept it?
They said it's kind of assumed that you accept getting a gift, and although he didn't actually accept it, like, he's never handed it, he talked about that he was going to get it, like, he made statements about acknowledging the gift to his friends.
Yeah, we have one piece of evidence, however, that argues against the idea that he accepted it. This is maybe tricky. Amanda, you see?
The son and his divorce proceedings, he failed to list it as a piece of his property.
Exactly. So he didn't, when he was listing, he got divorced somewhere between 1963 and 1989. And he's listing all of his property, right? Because it's divorce proceeding, you gotta list all your property. And he does not list the Klimt. He doesn't list the Klimt or his future interest in the Klimt as being property. I mean, very valuable property. You guys know who Klimt is?
Yes.
Alright. No! Oh, how about those? Those look familiar, Ira? No? No. Oh my goodness, we're going to have like an art education class in here. These are some of the most famous Klimt paintings. His paintings are fetched some of the highest prices in the entire world. I believe actually the highest price ever for any painting are his, like over Picasso or anybody. I believe that one, the Adele Bernhardt, this is Woman in Gold, which is like a movie about now. Anybody see it? Yeah, I haven't seen it. The Klimt paintings are also, there's a lot of case law about Klimt paintings because they often were involved, many of them were in Germany and were owned by Jews and then were confiscated by Hitler. And so there's been kind of very long struggles and stories of people trying to get their paintings back. I think that's what, did anyone see Woman in Gold? Is that what that's about? Okay, yeah. I know I should see it, but it's Austria, not Germany, but it's a similar story. I actually went to law school with somebody his grandmother had a Monet, and he was part of a big lawsuit to get it back too. So it's kind of a similar story. We have lots of interesting case law. I have friends who work in art law. If this is something that's interesting to you guys, there's a lot of law about kind of, we've read a surprising amount of art law so far in this class about kind of figuring out provenance and getting paintings back. All right, that's just your art education. All right, so the donative intent here, we've already covered, right? As long as the evidence establishes an intent to make a present and irrevocable transfer of title. The important thing that we want to think about in donative intent is it's not that they really mean for you to have it, and they're not planning to take it back. Because once you have a complete gift, you can't. His father could not have changed his mind and left that painting to somebody else in the will because he'd already given it away in the future interest. All right. Let's see. Here's the acceptance one, right? So in some ways, we have kind of this evidence we just talked about, right? That he held on to the letters. He kept them. He obviously understood that they were important. He told people about how he owned a Klimt, right? But he didn't report it in his divorce proceedings. There's not like a fast rule here. We just look at kind of the different factual circumstances and try and figure out whether it looks like acceptance. But we have, as we've talked about other places, a presumption. We presume that valuable things are accepted. So if we were to look at these three things and be like, okay, here's our pieces of evidence. We kind of have evidence that it feels equal. Then the presumption is going to go in favor of acceptance. You can overcome that presumption if we had, but we'd want to see very kind of firm statements from him that he wasn't accepting it. They write a letter back to his dad. He's like, I don't want that stinking Klimt. Keep it, right? Or he's like, yeah, it doesn't go with my wallpaper. You know, any of those things. We have to, because of where the presumption is for something valuable, we want to look for something very active to show that the person is rejecting it. In some ways, this is kind of akin to our abandonment ideas, right? That we assume that people don't abandon valuable property. And we could look at for really good evidence to show that they did. And we'd look for something, again, that said, I don't want that anymore. Get rid of it. All right. So let's think about this. So thinking about what we've learned here, let's do these two examples, and you can help me with these, Mike. All right, daughter admires mom's gold watch. Mom says, it's yours when I die. What do you think? Does that sound like a gift?
Yeah.
Sounds like a gift, right? Is there donative intent?
Yes.
Is there delivery?
The same as the grooming thing.
And I will assume acceptance because I made it a big, fancy, pretty gold watch there, my picture. All right, anybody want to argue against that? Not a gift. Everyone thinks this is a gift. This is yours when I die. Yeah, Ben.
Could argue that she finally she's giving it to her in the will.
What?
She doesn't say it's a gift, so she could be saying that she's going to leave it to her in the will.
It does sound like that. Maybe you said like, I'll put this in the will for you, right, Tabitha?
I mean, it's kind of up to speculation because she's for the inter vivos. She's still alive, and she's saying, "I'll give it to you when I die." But she doesn't meet the causa mortis element of the, or at least we don't.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm just trying to figure out if this is a. You're right. It doesn't meet causa mortis unless mom was like on her deathbed there. Right. Yeah, Christian.
Well, you just discussed that a gift has to be a present transfer.
Exactly. right? So we don't have a present transfer here. I will give this to you when I die. Sounds like a testamentary transfer, but it's probably an invalid testamentary transfer because she's not meeting the requirements of what goes into a will. If we have to... So notice how different that is. So look at the second one for us. Mom hands her watch, hands her the watch and says, here, it's yours, but I want to hold on to it until I die. Is that again?
Yes,
it is
more like
this. That's like what brings. So you see the difference here? It might seem subtle, but this difference can truly change ownership. Right? So if you give the person... Here it is yours, suggests a present intent to transform the property interest now. You have the property interest now. Think about it this way. If she wanted to go and get a loan based on that, she could not get a loan for the first one. Here's when I die. You know, anybody might change their idea about who they're going to give something to. If it's here it is yours now, it is hers now. She actually physically owns it, has a property interest. So that's a difference we see. Also, Mike, why did it make a difference in this case about whether or not it was he had given him the gift or not? In Bruin versus Bruin, right? If we had not found it to have been a gift back in 1963, who would have gotten it? The stepmother, right? Because he didn't write it in his will, so it would have gone to her as just part of kind of, she just got the rest of the estate. It wasn't named in the will. So trying to figure out what it was, how you characterize it, is often coming up in those types of controversies. Whether or not something was a gift given before death is really common to see in a will dispute. Because people want, and it's also a common thing that people want to do to avoid kind of all the problems with probate and estate taxes and stuff. Often people give gifts while they're alive to avoid them being part of the estate so they don't get divided up in that way. Yeah.
In the second hypothetical, how would you prove delivery if it's a verbal delivery?
Well, like, what is, yeah.
Because she's just, I mean, it's obviously like not in depth, but like.
So there's two, this is kind of goes to the ways I would say there's two ways to look at Gruen as well. One is she giving her just a future interest? If she's giving her just a future interest, it doesn't make sense to require actual delivery. So verbal delivery, maybe if they were worried about somebody challenging it later, they might want to put that in writing. If instead she's actually giving it to her now and her mother's just becoming the bailee, just kind of becoming the babysitter of her watch, she probably would have had to physically hand it to her. It's like, here's yours, but can I wear it? So you'd have to have, we want, those are the types of things we look at.
Okay.
So I'm just trying to get at the donative intent question. Yeah.
In the first example up there where it's not a gift, which of the three elements does it destroy? Like, which of them is not met?
Donative intent.
Okay.
So I keep thinking there, it's right there. Donative intent, right? Because we need the intent for a present transfer of interest. If your intent is to transfer an interest in the future, that's not yet a gift. That's not a gift until you have. Notice that this is a very tricky, it feels like it's funny. It's like, see, this is like, this. Giving a gift to somebody should be so easy, right? But this is a tricky thing. You have to have an intent to transfer the property right now. What you might be transferring could be the object itself, or it could be a future interest in the property. But what you're transferring, whether the property itself or the future interest, you have to transfer that right now. You can't say, someday I'm going to give you my watch. That's just not enough. Does that make sense? Okay. Just to use two kind of additional rules for delivery. One of these we kind of covered already with that gold coin. Delivery is not necessary when the property is already in the possession of the donee. So this is that gold coin example where the dad was like, you can just keep that gold coin. Right? Or you borrowed something from somebody. You borrowed somebody's car and then they won the lottery. And they say, you can keep my car. You already own it. You have to like drive it back so you get it again. And also you can have a third party deliver something for you. So I could hand something to my attorney and say, can you bring that over to my brother? And that would be kind of it would be actual delivery of a physical transfer of the item, even though the vehicle for that delivery was a third person. You can think of that as being like the mail too, right? Like I put it in the mail and it arrives. So that's a valid way for me to deliver it, even though I didn't actually, we didn't have like hand-to-hand contact. Yeah.
So saying that there's no donative intent for the tourist when I die.
For the what? I'm sorry.
Saying there's no donative intent for the first part. This is going back to the gold watch I just said.
Yeah.
Follow-up question. I understand why it's not an inter vivos gift, but isn't it a testamentary gift at that point?
Oh, okay, yes. But it's my only point about it would be it doesn't sound like a very valid testamentary gift because testamentary gifts have to meet all of the rules of a will. And your mom just telling you that you can have something when she dies is not going to meet all the requirements you need for how you transfer property upon that. That's why I say there's a different class you can take that teaches you all the different things that a will has to have it in. It has to be written, you have to have witnesses and stuff like that. That's all, you're right. It is a type of, it looks like somebody's trying to make a testamentary gift, but we're not going to say it's valid just because, think how messy it would be if we that just settle people's estates at the end. Well, mom said I can have a share. Mom said I can have this, right? But Charlie.
So if you have to come home and be testing that credit, it's executed as well?
Yes. Right. I mean, when you die, your stuff goes somewhere. But we don't think of all of that as gifts unless it's you actually kind of specifically spell it out. So if you just die without a will and all of your belongings pass by intestate succession, right? They go to your parents, your kids, or whatever, whatever the default rules are. We don't think of that as a gift. We think of it as a gift if you actually had a donative intent for them to go someplace and stuff like that. All right. Yes, Charlie.
What if she wrote that in a letter? Would that be considered a holographic one?
Yeah, maybe. Right. So I actually don't remember what the rules are for what you need in a holographic will. I think you might still need witnesses and stuff. But that's kind of getting into the details of wills. I just want us to think about the details of inter vivos gifts, right? I want to alert you to the idea that there's testamentary gifts out there, but we won't actually study in this class what the details are you need to make a valid testamentary gift. I just want to think about what we need to make a valid inter vivos gift and causa mortis. All right. More questions? All right. So thinking about these two additional rules I just gave you. Heather's not here today, but Sean and Heather are besties. Sean borrowed Heather's Ferrari last month and still has it in his garage. Yeah. Then you win the lottery, Sean, and then you call Heather and say, you can keep the Ferrari. I have it backwards. Look at that. I confused the names. Alright. But if, let's say, you lend Heather your Ferrari, then you win the lottery and say she can keep the Ferrari.
Does she have the keys to it?
I assume so. She's been borrowing it.
Well, it looks like it's a good gift to me.
Yeah, so this shows us a couple of things. One is that we don't have to have everything in that order. The donative intent, delivery, and acceptance. And we don't have to make Sean go back over to Heather's garage, get the car, and get the keys back and hand them to her again. We're not going to kind of require that formal proceeding. Now, in some places, they used to require that, and then people realized how silly it was. It was cumbersome. We have a lot of you'll see that our old property rules look a lot like that. Okay. All right, Tylene and Martha. All right, Tylene, you call Martha over to your locker and you show her your Babe Ruth rookie card and you say, hey, I want to give this card to Andy for some reason. Martha takes the card and tracks Andy down and hands it to him. Is that a gift? All right, do we have donative intent?
Yeah,
I want to give this card to Andy. That sounds like donative intent. Do we have delivery?
Yeah.
Right? So this is, again, this just goes to that rule that delivery via third person is fine. Okay. Are you going to accept that, Andy?
Oh.
Yeah. Again, we would presume that anything valuable is accepted. I assume it's valuable. No. You get here twice. Who knew? All right, Andy, you call your brother in your room. He points at a gold pen on his desk and declares, I give you this pen.
It's my pen.
Oh, sorry. You're the one giving it to your brother. You call your brother into his room and you say, "Here, I give you this pen." Is it his brother? Have you completed all of the things you need? Donative intent?
Yeah, I want to give you the pen.
All right. Is there delivery?
I'll mean, it's right there. You can just pick it up.
It's right there. You could just pick it up. This gets to a somewhat tricky rule about the actual delivery thing. There's some courts that would say it is so easy for you to pick it up and hand it to him that just pointing at it and indicating it is not enough. There's something about, we have to look at the characteristic of each item that you're talking about. It's not like too heavy. It would be, because it would be so easy for you to actually pick it up and hand it to him, some courts would require that level of actual delivery. Right? So think of how tricky this is. Now you have to look at each item that's being given and figure out what the circumstances are. The only reason this matters is if you try and take the pen back. Right? So most of our gift giving, we never answer these questions of whether it's donative intent to deliver. It only matters when there's a dispute. So all the time, I'm pretty sure pretty frequently, we are giving gifts in incomplete ways. We're pointing at something that we could easily pick up and hand somebody. We're kind of writing a letter that's kind of vague. All right? But the only reason it matters is if somebody tries to come and take it back, and then we have and it's challenged. So this is why we all the time are kind of not quite complete in our gifts.
It's yeah. Like a basic question, but you know how like sometimes if you receive like a gift, you could be like, oh, I can't accept this, like it's too much or something. Like could they like be like, oh well, you said you didn't accept it, but you're taking it, like what?
Yeah, be careful about that. No, I mean, we're going to look at the circumstances. I think people understand, like, oh, you're too generous. I can't accept this thing. But if you actually do, then pick it up and take it home with you. We will look at that as acceptance, right? If the person then tries to come back the next day and says, well, you said you couldn't possibly accept it. You didn't have acceptance. You can see how that could be a dispute. We would be like, was there acceptance or not? We'll have to get into that.
If a third party actually is the one who delivers the gift, and the donor, let's say, it makes a lot of sense, say the donor didn't actually tell the third party to do it, they just went and
not a gift, then.
So there's a gift.
Right, we have to have all three things present. So you have to have donor intent. If Tyson was just showing, say, hey, look at this baseball card that Andy wanted to see, go show it to him. And Martha just got the message wrong and actually gave it to him and thought that it wouldn't be a gift there because we, even though there's delivery acceptance, Helena didn't really have donative intent. So she can go and get it back for him.
But would, like, say she intended, but just not presently, but the delivery was not. So
no, I don't.
Let's say she had the intent to give him the card.
Okay, so Teddy wants to give Andy the card.
And Andy accepted it.
Okay.
But Helena didn't want to give him the card right now, but Martha decided to give it to him. Like, she intended to make, like, a future interest.
Well, then it wasn't a gift, right? Because the donor didn't... I'm not sure. Let me see if I understand you. The donor intent has to be a present desire to transfer property interest. If she did not intend for him to have the property at all yet, if she was thinking, I'm going to give this to him in 5 years, it wasn't valid at all. There was no present interest. If she, at that moment, intended to transfer a future interest, go show this to Andy. He has the future interest in this card. He gets it when I die. Then all she's transferred to him is a future interest. She can still go and get it back because she has not transferred to him a present interest in it. Does that make sense? Or is that just turning your brain on? Okay, good. All right. And everybody's favorite. Engagement rings. All right. Tyler? Say that again. A future interest is what? Future interest is if you have given a future interest, you've completed all three elements of the gift. You have the intent to give this future interest. You have delivered the future interest by symbolic or constructive or something like that. And the person accepted it. You cannot revoke that. They have it. So if you said you get this card, Andy, when I die. You have the present future interest. You said, I'm giving this card to you, but I'm going to keep it for the rest of my life. But if you have the future interest in this card, you can't take that back. You can't then decide later you want to give it to somebody else. You've already given that future interest away. Yeah? All right. Zach. Oh, you guys moved to be tricky. Zach P. Yes. Help us with Albinger v. Harris. Can you be a little louder? You have a deep voice, so you have to be a little bit louder than this.
Ellinger presented Harris with a ring in December of 95. They had a relationship for the next 3 years where it felt like they were qualifying, so they returned the ring. She returned the ring to him. You would give it back to her, sort of back and forth for about 3 years. And they, at one point in 97, he severely beat her and then forcibly removed the ring and left. They separated in 1998, and something about she ran up $1,000 in telephone charges, but he was paying all of them for that and that problem. But that was part of the what he's seeking recovery, the $1,000 and the recovery of the ring for his monetary value, because they had marriage plans, but those evaporated, and she refused to get back.
So all we really care about for our discussion here is the ring, right? We'll put aside that whatever she owed with all the phone bills or whatever. Okay, so for ring. So we have to try and figure out whether or not this ring looks like a gift. Do we have donative intent? Right, at the time the ring is handed to her, he intends for her to have the ring. Do we have delivery? Physical actual delivery, right? Slips it on her finger. And then what about acceptance?
Yeah.
Now, as a gift, one of the things is once the ring becomes hers, she could then abandon it or she could re-gift it, right? Those are all legitimate things. So having the ring go back and forth can change who owns the ring. So if she takes the ring off her finger and throws it back in his face, he's like, I don't want it anymore. It's yours now. We could either characterize that as a really aggressive gift, or as abandonment, and he picks it back up. But either way, we see that they have a tumultuous relationship where this ring is actually passing back and forth. What we care about is the last transfer of the ring. And the last transfer of the ring does meet all of these requirements. The last time is him giving it back to her, them reconciling, she accepts the ring, she puts it on their finger. Now what's... And then he also makes this lovely statement, right? Take the car, the horse, the dog, and the ring, and get out. Seeming to suggest that he views the ring as being in her ownership as well. Now we have something that's different about engagement rings. Why, Zach, why isn't this case just over once we've shown that it meets the three qualifications of a gift?
Well, I think it was sort of that there was an expectation that if you gave him a ring, that he would get something in return. Maybe, marriage, I guess, would be some more of a contract, unless you know.
Yeah. We have an idea in some states that a ring is a different, an engagement ring is a different type of gift than other rings. So remember, the key thing we just talked about is if you meet the three qualifications of making a gift, you can't go and take that back. It is that person's. You cannot change your mind about it. But some states acknowledge that we should think about engagement rings a little bit differently because it is a gift given in expectation of marriage. And if the marriage doesn't happen, you should be able to get it back. This becomes what we call a conditional gift. Conditional gifts are largely not permitted. Although, think about how often they occur, right? You could think about a parent saying, I'm going to give you, I do this, right? Here, I give you this toy. You can have this My Little Pony. Her obsession with My Little Pony. Their house, right? You can have these My Little Ponies. They are yours. I'm giving them to you. However, if you do not treat your sister nicely, I am taking them back away.
That is actually not legal.
Like, if my daughter were to take me to court and challenge me on that, I have given her a completed gift. I cannot give her a conditional gift. I cannot make conditions on the things we give people. Right? So if you try to do this with your stuff, if you give somebody something and you say, you can have my property book, but you can only have it if you give it to somebody next year who needs it. I want it to be passed out. You're not allowed to do that. You have given it to them, that person, and you can't make a condition on that gift. We'll see that this gets a little bit different with real property. You can make conditions on the land. But as personal property, you can't. We do not recognize conditional gifts, except for two categories. Engagement rings and gift causa mortis. So we'll get to gift causa mortis next. So engagement rings. We recognize, and not every state, but many states recognize that this could be a conditional gift. A gift that you get back if marriage does not occur. Alright. Did you guys know that rule? Anybody here? I know there's a few people who are married or engaged. And anybody think that they would get the? Anybody think about who would get the ring if you broke it off? Right, Zach, aren't you married?
Yeah.
Did you present her with a ring?
Yeah.
Did you think if she dumps me, I'm gonna get that ring back?
No, I wouldn't want it.
You wouldn't want it. It'd be tainted. Oh. Oh, you got some sympathy. Ben?
Christmas. And an attorney friend said that because he gave it to her on holiday, and he couldn't get it back. That's the exception because it was like a considered a gift outside of marriage contract.
All right. I'm going to put that one on hold for a minute. We'll come back to it. Let's finish this case really quickly. All right. What is the rule in Montana about conditional gifts? Is engagement ring a conditional gift in Montana?
No. The Montana gift law makes no provision for conditional gifting except for gift in contemplation of death.
Right, so they say, okay, in Montana our rule is going to be the only conditional gift we're going to allow is going to be the gift causa mortis. We're not going to allow other conditional gifts. What is the reasoning, Zach? What's the reasoning that the court gives for why they're not going to adopt this exception that many other states have?
It's sort of a gender bias.
It is a gender bias argument. Did you understand the argument they're making?
A little bit, because something about the canceled weddings and stuff like that the women would have to bear the cost. So it would send them to some cost for the women, but not the men.
Yeah, so they had it was passed in this state, as they have in many states, something that I think they call them like the anti-heart balm statutes. I don't quite understand the phrase, but these ideas that we weren't going to kind of... some of it was that we're going to kind of try to create gender parity within the law, and that includes the law of property. The court says, well, when we do that, when we create this gender parity and no longer allow conditional gifts, we've actually done this weird thing where the women are more likely to lose out, lose money, in many ways, at a broken off marriage than the men. Right, the women are the ones who are the... I have no idea what study he pulled this from or whatever, but he says women are the more likely to have spent money ahead of time by buying the dress, buying, I don't know, a ring for the case. That it's more likely that the women are outlaying these expenses. Like, perhaps the idea that the women's family pays for the wedding, the women buy dresses are expensive, type of thing. And he says, so therefore, all of these rules we made that were supposed to be for gender equality... They're actually, women are still going to be the ones who are most likely to be harmed in the end. So the least we can do is let them keep the ring to offset that. That's the theory that the majority gives. And here's the quote, right? If the court were to fashion exception for the engagement ring under the gift law theories, we would perpetuate gender bias. Right? And so we should get rid of these rules. The dissent, I was like, I'm fine with the result, but I have no idea why this is about gender bias. All right, let's see. Public policy. What should our public policy be about engagement rings? Is there a good reason to allow them to be conditional gifts or not? What do you think, Zach?
Well, you're looking at it. So it's sort of like personhood.
Well, whatever it is, it's a personhood, right? If we just kind of think about all of our laws, we usually have a public policy justification for how our laws are structured. There are certain activities we want to encourage or discourage. So if we think about it, if we make a rule that says we are going to allow people to get their rings back, I'm not sure what behavior, let's just think, what behavior does that encourage if you propose to somebody and you get your ring back?
It encourages a lot of
people just giving rings and not worrying about the fact that they won't get it back.
So that's interesting. Okay, maybe more people actually are, maybe makes people more likely to propose because they realize that they are this, like, this whatever, this one's like a $29,000 ring, right? Maybe they feel like, well, if it doesn't work out, I'll at least get that back. So maybe we get all of a sudden a lot more proposals out there. I'm not sure if that's true. I mean, another thing we might get if we create that rule. Yeah, Jayla?
Don't encourage the guy to buy more expensive ring.
Maybe it encourages men to buy more expensive rings. Maybe it's good for the economy, right? We'll encourage people to actually invest more money in rings because there's this thought that they'll get it back. Tim?
I think it might encourage women to be better partners.
Is. Whoa, exactly. Think of that annoying rule. And think about being the court. Think about now you have to be the judge that has to listen to these two people squabbling about whose fault it is that the engagement fell apart so that they can award the ring to somebody.
A disaster.
A disaster. Terrible public. Like, one of our ideas about law is thinking about judicial efficiency and things like this. This is like not the type of dispute you want to put in a courtroom. This is why in New York and other states we have kind of these no-fault rules, but a lot of states have kind of this idea that we're going to figure out if you're the one who caused the dissolution of this relationship, you're the one who loses the ring.
We do want to also encourage in getting it back, especially if, like, a lot of people do, like, family heirlooms, if they'll use their mom's ring or something like that.
I think that's a good point, right? We want to encourage people to be able to get the ring back because it's not just something they bought at Kay's, but it's like was their great grandmother's. So you can see these are the types of things that the courts and the legislatures are thinking, mostly here the legislatures. Most states now have laws on this. It's not by common law like it is in Montana. It's mostly kind of a statute that's written, and the legislature has exactly this debate. What types of things do we want to encourage? All right. Now, for those of you, Zach and others, who have given engagement rings, did you know what the rule was about whether or not you get it back? So this also brings up the idea that we talk about all this idea of public policy about what activities we're encouraging. It doesn't really matter if the people actually buying the rings have no idea that these are the rules, right? So if we're saying, oh, you know, if we make this rule, or maybe people will be more likely to buy more expensive rings because of this idea that they might get it back, I just would present to you that it's a very small portion of the people out there who are going to even know that fact and take it into their calculation. Perhaps those of you who are not yet engaged will now think about that if you ever present a ring, or one of the traditions I know is about women who present fancy watches. I went to a women's cup, so there's a lot of women who did proposing. And you do by usually presenting like a fancy watch instead of a ring. So can you get these? So you might think a little differently about how you're selecting that item. To your husband to give to you, right? That's just a gift that your family made to you, and he was like the transferer, right? He's just like you handing off the baseball card. All right. Okay. So the ruling, this is ruling is really unique to Montana. Not many states have it. Oh, does anybody know this case? This was last year. I love this guy. He owns like Chef's Restaurant. Is that his place?
Yeah.
Okay, right? Okay. So in New York, here, I'll show you first. Here's the New York rule. Engagement ring is the nature of a pledge for contract of marriage. So if the recipient breaks off the engagement, she's required upon demand to return the ring on the theory that it constituted a conditional gift. This guy broke up via text. So this is why I love him, right? He's a very classy guy. He was engaged to this woman. He broke up with her via text. And in the text, when he called off the engagement, he said she could keep the ring as a $50,000 parting gift. So what happened there? He lost that ring. He lost that ring because even though actually New York law says that he could have gotten that ring back, his text, they say, constituted a gift of the ring. Right? Remember, donative intent? I mean, it might be an anger, but it sure sounds like he's giving her the ring. We don't need actual delivery if she's already in possession of it, and we are going to assume acceptance of a really valuable item. The rule of, I don't know, not breaking up with people via text and saying things hastily, right? I'm sure his lawyer is really sad he didn't run that by him before him. Okay, all right, so let's go to, however, the conditional gift that all courts, all states do recognize, a gift causa mortis. And Sean, can you help us with this one?
All right, so plaintiff is going to undergo a surgery, and plaintiff...
Not plaintiff.
Wasn't?
Well, she's dead now, so she's not the plaintiff.
All right, so someone was going to undergo a surgery and gave some items to the friend, expecting or thinking that the surgery might kill her. The surgeon only made a small incision, said we can't go through with the surgery without killing her, and now she didn't die from the surgery. So the issue was, who receives the things? Like, who receives the gifts that she made fearing her imminent death?
Exactly. So now we have to look at the rules for gift causa mortis. So this is her. This is some of the jewels she's actually wearing, I guess. This is Maria. Brind, you might be thinking that she's the plaintiff because it's the same last name, but the Brind and the who's the plaintiff is her husband, or her widow, I should say. The widower, right? Okay, gifts causa mortis. Here are the rules we need for gift causa mortis. We still have this idea of donative intent, delivery, and acceptance. That doesn't change. It still is a gift. But it's a conditional gift, and there's some twists on it. You have to give this while you are alive. Otherwise, it's a testamentary gift. So it can't be something that like people find the piece of paper later. It has to be something that you actually transfer the interest in it while you're living. It has to be given because you anticipate your death. You get it back if you don't die. So if she hadn't died, she would get these jewels back again. The tricky thing in this case, and it happens more often than you think, is she didn't actually die from what she thought was going to kill her. Right? She thought she was really afraid of going under the knife. She really thought that the surgery was going to kill her. But what killed her was the tumor that they were going to remove in the surgery. They seem pretty closely related, though. So what do we do, Sean? How do we figure out whether or not she should be able to... These should be valid gifts causa mortis.
We just go through them step by step.
Okay.
So she was alive when she gave the gift. She was fearing her death of the surgery, like you said. She didn't die. So she should be able to get them back.
But so then we have to think about... Oops, I'm going the wrong way here. Oh, I don't have the next slide. Oh. So we have to think about kind of what she was actually afraid of. And we have this letter here. So think of how narrow this is. Like if she is saying, I'm afraid, I guess I'm so sick, I'm going into surgery, that I'm going to die. And then maybe that would have been enough, right? Because then we'd be like, well, the whole circumstance is this tumor she has. How does the court read it? How specific do we have to get? Is it okay that she died of the underlying illness, or does it have to be the surgery that she died of?
The court decided that the defendant doesn't get the items because she died of the tumor, not complications from the surgery, or in the immediate, few days after the surgery.
Now, what happens right after the surgery? So, gift causa mortis, we know one of the things about a gift is if you don't die, what you're afraid of, she doesn't die of the surgery, she has the ability to go and get the thing back. She can go back and she can go get those jewels back. Does she do so?
I think so. In a minute since I read the case.
Yeah. She doesn't, right? What does she do?
Okay. Well, when she starts to be sick, like later on, the lawyer comes to her and says, if you die, you still have in your will that you're giving these gifts upon death of your surgery, of the surgery, right?
You're close. It's not in her will, though, right? This is the tricky part. Right? We don't have something in her will that these things are not disposed of in her will. In her will, her estate just goes to her husband. She has not specifically spelled out who gets the jewels. So we understand the dispute, right? If it's just part of her estate, if these jewels went back to her estate, then the husband gets them. If instead they were actually validly transferred as gift cards mortis, they're going to go to her friends. Her will doesn't dispose of them. So what happens when she doesn't die in the surgery?
She recovers, right?
She recovers. What does she do about the jewels, though? Does she go back and get them? No. Yeah.
Her lawyer told her that the gift might be valid and that she should probably take further action, and she chose not to and left in the trust.
Yeah, right? So her lawyer alerts to the fact that there might be an issue here because she didn't actually die what she thought of. Maybe she should do something about it. What does she say?
Yeah. She's like, I'll think about it and I'll let you know.
Yeah, I'll think about it. I have like 2 hours left to live. This is like not really top of my agenda right now. Right? Let me get back to you on that if I feel like it. So we see actually, from looking at these circumstances, what do you think her intent was? Now, Sean, what do you think she wanted? Do you believe that she wanted, because she didn't die in surgery, she would rather the jewels go back to her husband? Or do you think she really wanted to give them to her friends?
Well, given that she didn't change it after her attorney told her that the gift might be valid now that she survived the surgery, I think she probably intended to give them to the jewelry to whomever was listed prior to the surgery.
Anybody think that she probably intended it to go to her husband? How are you doing?
I just don't think it's unreasonable coming out of a surgery that you will have probably a lot of appointments, a lot of things in your mind, you're kind of old, and so there's a lot of things going on, so it's not unreasonable that she didn't take immediate action to cancel the gift.
Absolutely. I think we can all put ourselves in her shoes and realize, like, she had written this thing of who her jewelry is going to go to. It's going to go to her friends. She is now realizes she's really going to die. If she was afraid, if she was like thinking she might be worried about the surgery, now she knows death is coming. She's got a lot of things to think about. She's probably pretty uncomfortable. And her lawyer already knows who she wants all the jewels to go to. I think we can see. My interpretation, drawing reasonable inferences from the statements she made, from the letters back and forth, is that her intent is for these jewels to go to her friends. So this is why we have the dispute going on in the court, because we have kind of one of our big kind of public policy desires is to fulfill the will, to fulfill the wishes of the donor. Usually we want to try and figure out, usually our goal is like we want to read these things and figure out what they really meant, and our goal is to try and do what they really wanted to do. So here we see from the circumstances, it really sounded like she wants her jewelry to go to her friends. But a rigid application of the law has it going back to the husband, back to the estate. So in this court, so you can see actually this court was not very sympathetic with her and her desires, and had a very strict adherence to the law. Very strict feeling that, like, she did not die of exactly what she said she was going to die of, so it automatically went back to her, and therefore it's going to pass with her estate. Some jurisdictions find this to be a slightly harsh articulation of this rule, so some jurisdictions are more willing to look at the circumstances and try and divine what their actual intent is. Many jurisdictions actually create a window, a kind of a temporal window. So if you die kind of around the same time, right? They say if death occurs within the same time frame or is related to the anticipated peril. Right? So you can see how maybe you're afraid because you're going on a trip to a dangerous place and you're afraid of being in the dangerous place, but what really happens is you die in a car crash on the way to the airport. People will say, well, so of course we'll say, well, that was kind of within the same time frame, or another court would say it's kind of related. It was all kind of the same trip or journey you were taking. So some courts have been very willing to kind of broaden this idea of how close we have to be to the cause of death, because their goal is to fulfill the desires and the wishes of the donor. Nate.
I
got
missed some of the reason. What would the policy reason be for, like, the differences in positives.
Just the policy reasons are just that we want people that we don't really like gifts causa mortis. We don't like these conditional gifts at all. So we're going to be very narrow in construing them. So we're going to kind of look very specifically at what they thought they were going to die of. You're right. The policy. I don't think the policy reason is as good of a justification. But we also have this background idea that we want really nice settled rules of law because they're easier for us to understand and they're easier for courts to understand. If everybody understands. If your attorney knows you need these three things to prove a gift, to show a gift causa mortis, your attorney can much better represent you, and opposed to them saying, well, they're going to take a bunch of things to account and think about your intentions and stuff like that. It's so there's a public policy reason that's just having settled rules. Tim.
So, did her friends lose possession as soon as she didn't die?
So that is what is, I think, unanswered here. This court says yes. The court suggests here that as soon as she didn't die of that of what she feared, right, that they did not have possession, that it was no longer a gift. I think that some jurisdictions read this more broadly too and say, no, it just means it is revocable. It doesn't mean it's automatically revoked. So it could show. So I think the better rule, and I don't know. I think this is the minority rule, but I think it's the better rule, is that you have to go and ask for your stuff back.
Because her letter said, to be returned on demand.
And she never made a demand.
Yeah,
but I think the court just wants to so narrowly construe a gift causa mortis that they're not willing to kind of look at her intent. I think the circumstances here show her intent is for them to keep it. And her lack of going and asking for it back, I think in other jurisdictions would suggest that it remains with those people because she didn't come and demand it back. So courts just look, conditional gifts are messy. Right, and so this is the only conditional gift we allow in every state. Some states allow this the engagement rings as a conditional gift, but courts are so disfavoring of these special rules that they construe them quite narrowly. Yeah.
This might sound a little out there, but I can think of a possible public policy reason. Like if somebody were sick and thought they were going to die very soon, and they bequeathed something very valuable. And the person who they're supposed to be giving it to thinks they're not dying fast enough. They might suddenly die from lung cancer.
All right.
That would be a reason to specify.
Yes, although it's you could have something similar happen with just the existence of wills too, right? Like that. So yeah, it's very morbid. All right, it's possible. Okay, let's. Are there any more? So this is we're wrapping up gifts here. Are there any other questions?
This is kind of a weird question, but what would be the point of doing a causa mortis gift versus putting it in will?
Just because you want it back if you don't die.
Okay.
Mostly, right? Like, yeah. Like, I think I'm really so first of all, you have to really be in fear for your life, right? So I really am afraid of flying. Let's say I truly am afraid. It's not true. But I truly am afraid of flying, and I just worry that my plane is going to crash. Before I get on my plane flight, I hand over my car keys to somebody and say, I'm probably not going to survive this, so you can have my car. Right? So this is a gift causa mortis because I'm giving him that gift because I think I'm going to die. And so therefore, when I survive this plane ride and I come back home, I want my car back. Right? And we don't want to force somebody to write a will every time, spelling out all the details, because usually a will is supposed to settle your whole estate. This would just be like one or two things, right? All right. Yeah.
Wouldn't you die of something else, like a heart attack on the plane?
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying, right? if we follow Bryn, it's not enough. I have to die in the plane crash. I mean, maybe we could say the heart attack on the plane was due to my fear of the plane or something, right. But this is why courts say this narrow rule of it being so specific, we could extend to be anything that was either near enough temporally or something that's part of the same thing that you're afraid of. Like, so her idea, like, I'm afraid of being really sick and having a tumor, it should have been enough that it didn't matter which, like, procedure it was that killed her. So...
This is a big part of giving a gift to avoid going through your will, because if you say I'd like Medicaid debt, then your will is going to get kind of chopped up.
Absolutely. That might be one of the reasons why you want to do this instead of a will, is because you want to. But like, your timing is hard here. Like, a will, right? We could all sit down and write these today, right? A gift causa mortis? Anybody in fear or anticipation of immediate death? If so, this is like not where I'd spend my time. Right? So none of us can make a gift causa mortis today. They really are exceptional circumstances. They are usually deathbed gifts, is the idea, right? That's why I had some picture like that. All right, Hyra.
The reason, the scenario where I thought this would happen is like you get into a car accident and you know you've lost some blood, you're probably going to die. And you probably write something in the ambulance or tell the ambulance person to write it down about the hospital. That's like the first thing that came to my mind.
That's exactly what we're talking about. That's what I'm saying. It's like deathbed gifts. We're not going to make all of the same requirements we make for like wills and stuff. This person, maybe they never wrote a will because they didn't realize they were going to be in a car accident. I mean, how many people here have a will? Two, right? You know, so like, so you can picture if one of us is like suddenly gets really sick, we might start making gift causa mortis because you haven't already thought about this. All right, let's wrap this up. Yeah.
So you're saying it's a deathbed gift, but like, couldn't somebody or two people ever argue that you're not in the right state of mind to make that kind of gift?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's like a separate thing. So maybe somebody challenges your donative intent.
Yeah.
They say you didn't really have donative intent because you were insane or something. But that's a separate kind of issue. That would be getting at our intent prompt, because you still have to have the donative intent, delivery, and acceptance. All right. Was there any more questions on gifts? All right, let's take a 10-minute break and we'll come back and do a state. All right, so I will acknowledge that many people find estates to be complicated and confusing. Yeah, I'll get a lot of done. But I think the basics are very straightforward. What happens is that we get into a lot of kind of complicated law rules and exceptions and things like that. And we have both estates that are kind of what we think of as the present and who owns things, and then we have to think about those messy future interests that we started to hear hints about in some of our other cases. If you like logic puzzles, there's so few of you who studied math here. If you like logic puzzles, if you studied math, actually, those people tend to, my scientists in the room, well, we have a bunch of econ people though, right? They really tend to like estates because they're just kind of logical learning tricks and puzzles. It is a strange thing that we spend so much time on it in law school. I spend a week on it, and actually that's, okay, we'll spend a week on it and change, maybe three classes total to something like that. And that's actually less than the other classes do. A lot of classes spend a lot of time on this because people find it so confusing, because it's on the bar. I'm willing to spend as much time as we need to get through this. But I also want to point out to you that this is so little of how much of, like, if we're just thinking about if we think about whether or not your property class should correlate to the top, how much time and how energy the topics are on the bar, covering estates makes sense. If we think about how much whether or not property law should actually correlate to the things you do as an attorney, studying estates doesn't make a lot of sense. Right? I will help you with it. It is on the bar. It's interesting. But as you will quickly see, only 1% of our property in the United States, of our real property, actually runs into these issues. The things we'll talk about later, landlord-tenant, easements, those are kind of pervasive, important topics. But I don't want you to be like too intimidated by it. I think one of the things that is confusing about this is terminology. There's a lot of terminology and phrases and stuff that we haven't seen before and we don't normally use. I do think this is the type of topic, like making yourself a little one-page chart will get you pretty far. There is, I think, one at the end of the chapter in your textbook that you can look at. Although I think actually constructing your own and having to sit down and figure it out yourself is often helps you learn it better than just looking at somebody else's little chart. All right. History lesson. Well, there's a little bit of history in here. You know, one of the things that we have to understand is that in England, all the land was held by the king. So if we thought about who the property owner was back in 1066, right, it was the king owned everything. And so then all of the people who actually lived on and worked the land all were kind of in some ways tenants of the king, right? They were all like renters in a way. And the way that the land was divided up was that the lords were given kind of big areas of land, huge areas of land. And in return for that big area of land, they had to give stuff back to the king. Usually, sometimes money, but often like you had to like provide knights and soldiers for war. And so how did they get those knights and soldiers? Well, the lords then divided up their land, right, and gave pieces of their land out and got it in exchange for people agreeing to show up if there was war or provide vegetables. So it was kind of this tiered system that all, where the ownership, the actual ownership, if we think of who held title to the land, was always the king. And so then all of the rules that were underneath it were always kind of these rules that meant that you could not pass on your land to whoever you wanted. Like, the king always had ultimate rules over it. So things we think about today for how property works and how we transfer it to people was not how it worked in England. And we have inherited the English system, and over time, as we realized how cumbersome these rules are, we've changed them like one by one. But having this background in history helps us understand some of the weird phrases and things we got. This is just the feudal system. People actually had to pay the king or the lord or the knight if they wanted their property to go pass to their children, right? So over time, things grew. Alright, so let's look at phrases. Alright, so we're going to be talking about estates and land. And there's three kind of categories here. One is present possessory estate. What I mean by that is property that you actually currently possess. You currently own it. Not only are you the owner, not only do you have the deed, you have the ability to possess and occupy that land. I mean, maybe you choose to rent it out or something like that, but you are the possessor of the land today. I'm going to contrast that with non-possessory estates, which we don't study yet. We study that when we get to easements and covenants, which says that there are rights you can have in the land, even if you're not the person who holds it and occupies it. Like, a brief example of this without getting into too far ahead of ourselves is the idea of a pathway. Right, you have the right to driveway goes through somebody else's land, so you have the right to pass the land. You're not actually the owner of the land, you just have this right as a non-owner. You have some right or interest in the land. Maybe you have the right to go hunting on somebody's land. We'll see how these emerge, but we have this idea of these non-possessory interests. We're really concerned right now with just the present possessory estates. We then have associated with that future interests, which you've already kind of heard hints about. These are property rights that you hold today, but you do not currently have any possessory rights today. You don't even have these non-possessory rights. All of your rights in the property exist are things that will become possessory in the future. Right now, you just have kind of a right to get it one day. So today, we're going to spend our time learning the main possessory estates and see how far we get. Freehold versus non-freehold. Freehold is like ownership, and non-freehold is like having a lease. I don't actually find that term very helpful. I just point it out to you in case we see like an old case or place where they mention it. If you see somebody talking about a non-freehold estate, that usually means that they're a renter. They're leasing the land. it's just good to know so you don't get too confused. All right, so then this is just kind of the idea of the feudal system that I was talking about, right? This kind of this property rights all in relation to each other. This also echoes back to what we talked about on the first day, right? That property is really not about the thing itself. It's about the relationship and rules we have regarding each other. So here we have the actual land itself, but the rights you have are more akin to things like requirements to, like, you know, I can keep you off, but in exchange for keeping you off the land, I have to give you some of the crops I grow, stuff like this. I forgot I had that in there. That's for you nerds. Yeah. Right? Yeah. All right. So this is the idea. I love the people who have no idea what this is. All right. This is like, I always like this, calling the banners. What does that mean? Call the banners means assemble the banners. All right, that's not very helpful. What does that mean when they call the banners in Game of Thrones?
Get your troops ready for battle.
Get your troops ready for battle. But not only that, where are the troops coming from?
The land.
Yeah, right? So if you, I haven't actually seen the show, but I've read all of the books multiple times. If you read, you know, in, every time they call the banners, all of the farmers and stuff are always the ones fighting, right? They are calling every house. So this is very much a feudal system, right? Every house, has like an area of land that is theirs, and they call upon all of their tenants, all of their bannermen, all of those people who owe them something, have to show up and fight for them. That is kind of it's very similar to kind of the property system in medieval England. All right, nerdiness done. All right, okay, and then we just have this, I just like some of these, we see this development, and it's in the book, so I won't read it, I won't go over it in too much detail, so we can get over for that. But we see each of these rules here, each of these passes, the Magna Carta, the Statute Quiatoris, all the Statute of Frauds, these are all things that we realize over time that the feudal system has a lot of archaic rules in it that don't work very well for how we think about property today. For thinking about the person who's actually in possession of it having rights, right? The feudal system was not a just and equitable system. So each of these rules and these changes in the law, you see kind of spelling out changes in society and moving towards equality. And they changed our property law. You can the Phaethonic Livery Stipend. Well, this is what you were talking about. Was it? See, he didn't even know. This is because today we have very good land recording systems. Well, they're all right. But we have land recording systems where people can, like, record a deed, you can look it up, you can figure out who owns stuff, you can look back who owned the property over and over across the years. We didn't used to have land recording systems. So if you're trying to figure out who owned the property, you have to kind of do, like, sometimes an investigation. If there was a dispute between two people, you have to do this investigation to see who had a better claim to it. So they used to do this really kind of strange ceremonies when you transferred land to somebody. So if I was going to transfer my land to somebody, I would do so by handing them a clump of dirt, a stick, something symbolizing the land, and I would hand it to them. And we would do it in front of witnesses, so that they could then attest to it later on about the transfer of land. And hopefully you would try getting some young kids in there so that they would remember long. You slap them so they remember it better. Oh, yeah, that time I got slapped while Dad handed dirt to somebody. I think I was 8, you know? Right? Because the younger they are, the better your record. So this is how cumbersome land transfers were. Especially when there's no presumption. If there's no presumption that your land is going to go to your son, go to the kids or something like that, go to your next relative, you can see how it led to a very kind of weird and cumbersome rules. And some of those have residuals that we still have to deal with. But mostly this is what we're talking about. The freehold estates. Fee simple absolute, life estate, and fee tail. Those are the three essential ones, and those are the ones we'll probably have time for today. And then we get to the defeasible fees. Does anyone know what the word defeasible means? No. It means to cut short. So defeasible are all ways that your land ownership could be cut short, all ways that you might lose your land. But this is the essence of it. So fee simple absolute. Had anyone heard that phrase before you read it in the textbook? One? Two people? All right. Not so many. But fee simple absolute, or sometimes you'll just hear people refer to it as fee simple. This means ownership of the property, that you own that property and you have all the rights to it. And we think of this as being, you don't just own it for your life, you don't just own it until you get married. You own it. You don't have any limitations or restrictions. Other than the restrictions and limitations that we all have just by being members of society, right? We can think of, like, you're not allowed to do illegal things and stuff like that. But other than that, the fee simple ownership is the strongest form of ownership. Most people who own real property own it in fee simple ownership. 99% of property is owned in the United States is owned in fee simple ownership. The current there's no future interest associated with this. Current and future possession are all solidified in one landowner. It is the most desirable and the most powerful because you can. This is how you can get the most money for your land, right? There's no restrictions on my land. This is, I'm going to get the best price for it if I can sell it with no restrictions on it. It's going to fulfill our policy goals of not only having kind of marketable land, but using our land in the most efficient way. We can choose what we think is the best way to fulfill our economic desires or something with our land if there's no restrictions on it. And this is important. It's alienable, divisible, descendable. Those are words that might not be familiar. But alienable. What do we mean by alienable?
You can convey it.
You can convey it. You can transfer it. To alienate is not meaning to offend somebody in this case, right? To alienate means that you are transferring, you are giving away your property in some way, you are conveying it. And these are the phrases we use for that. We usually do it in a deed. It's a conveyance of land or a grant of land. You hear people talk about the grantor of land and the grantee being the one who accepts it. Those are the phrases and terms we'll see when you have alienation. To say something is divisible is just a fancy word for saying it's passed by will. Divisible, it means you have a piece of property, you can leave it to somebody in your will. And we use the term devise, and then we use the word, the person who gets it is either the testator or devisee. So fee simple, absolute. You can convey it freely to whoever you want. You can sell it, you can give it away. You can leave it to somebody in your will. And then descendable means it can pass by intestate succession. So what I mean by that is you forgot to write a will. And we just follow kind of the default rules of our state of what happens to your property if you didn't write a will. I would think for most of you in this room that means your property is going to your parents, maybe your spouse if you're married, maybe to your kids if you have them, right? There's just kind of, those are default rules. This, we can think of this as our right to transfer. Our right to transfer is really strong if we have a fee simple absolute. We can transfer in all these different ways that it might be able to transfer. We will see that for some of our other ways of holding property, we don't have all this freedom. We might have a restriction on how, on whether or not you can pass it by will, or a restriction on whether or not you can pass it by a conveyance. All right. Here's what it looks like when you see it written down. This is the phrase that helps us identify a fee simple absolute. From O to A and her heirs. That is the traditional embodiment phrasing that we see for a fee simple absolute. And her heirs. This is a phrase, and her heirs, that is just serving to identify it as a fee simple absolute. We shouldn't actually read into it any desire for this person to pass the property to their heirs. We actually just read it as creating a fee simple absolute, which we know they're allowed to transfer in any of the ways that they want to, as we just saw in the last slide, right? So then this is like a term of art and her heir. It is not a requirement, it's not a limitation on the land in any way that that's what A has to do. This phrase we see under the common law was required. If you didn't have and her heirs, you did not view it as a fee simple absolute. Today, and we'll see a case on this, today we realize that that phrase and her heirs seems unnecessary. So all jurisdictions in the United States today now recognize from O to A as being a valid transfer of fee simple absolute. Sometimes use the other phrases, from O to A forever and ever. Right? Those are just, those would all be fee simple absolutes. What we say when this transfer occurs is that A has a fee simple absolute. O has nothing. What do A's heirs have? Nothing. Not only that, they don't even exist yet. Do you know what your heirs are? Those are the people you get your stuff when you die. But only if you die without a will. So your heirs and inheritance, we often think of inheritance as being like what was left to us in somebody's will. You think of your heirs as being the people you named in your will. Heirs is actually the phrase in the law that we use for intestacy. This is when you didn't have a will. It also means we cannot identify those people until you are dead. So none of us actually have heirs at this moment. Even if we could, like, pull up the law and figure out who it is that's going to get our stuff based on kind of the rules of intestacy, we don't name anybody as our heirs until we're dead. So we can't actually identify who somebody's heirs. You can have an heir apparent, which is like following the rules, who is the one who's likely to get your property. But so this phrase, and her heirs, is not a rule that it has to actually pass to your heirs when you die, or that they get some ownership that they're sharing with you right now. Yeah? Okay. Here's the structure of it. This, I'll teach you these phrases in case you find them helpful. I don't think it's... some people do, some people don't, but it's just kind of... So words of purchase. So every time we look at one of these conveyances, there's always what we call words of purchase. I don't know why they're called that, but what they mean is the words designating who gets the land. So here it identifies the grantee. So just the word 2A is the words of purchase. If you gave it to a few people, it would be to A and B. Right? Those are our words of purchase. They're just identifying who's going to get the land, who's the grantee. The words of limitation that follow 2A explain to us what they're getting, what form of estate they're getting. Right? So, and his heirs identifies the form of the estate as being a fee simple. We'll see when we get to life estate and fee tails. We'll have other words of limitation, the other little phrases or magic words that help us identify which estate. Right? The words of limitation could also be like forever, the ones that are like forever and ever, stuff like that. All right, so let's think about this in context with the Cole case. James, can you help us with this one?
The pension defendant entered into a contract for real estate, is what I was kind of and the plaintiff submitted a deposit of $420 and spent $50 on title search until the closing date of July 1st. But when the title search came back, it found a defect in the title, in which Cole's refused to buy the property.
What's the defect, right? So okay, this,
and the heirs.
Right. So this is a right common practice, right? You want to buy a property, you do kind of, put some money down, and you're like, okay, we're just gonna, as long as the title search works out, we'll follow through with this. Title comes back. This is the contract that they had, right? If he was unable to convey title, then he could reject the deed. That's a weird. I don't know, that first word is looking weird. What is it that the title does say?
It says, and his assigns forever.
And his assigns forever, right? Not one of our magic word phrases. It says, conveys the property to the grantee and assigns forever, not and his heirs. So if we're in a very strict application of the common law rule where we require that phrase and his heirs, we do not have a transfer of fee simple absolute. What would we have a transfer of then, James? Were you able to determine that? This is trickier, perhaps.
I guess the... They would only have a... No, I guess it's not really good.
Wouldn't it be a life estate?
It's a life estate. So what we have to deal with here are presumptions, right? So often we talk about what do we do when we're not clear, when what we have before us doesn't give us something that's very clear. Often we'll look to presumptions to help break this tie. Under the common law, a presumption was a life estate. This only makes sense if we think about this in terms of feudal England, right? Because you would only be you only gave properties to somebody for the term of their life, with the idea that then the property would come back to the king and he could redistribute it to somebody else. So if you were unclear, all you got was a life estate. Common law, that's the common law rule. That changes. Our modern day presumption is in favor of a fee simple absolute. Right? I think that just actually makes sense to a lot of us. We would not assume that when we got a piece of property, if it wasn't clear that we were only getting it for our lifetime, we assume we're getting something that we can leave for our kids that we can pass other people and so on. So our modern presumption is in favor of a fee simple absolute. In this court, we're still looking at a court that this time is following the common law presumption. So when the property, when the deed wasn't clear, that means they only got a life estate. Now, I'm trying to remember what this name is. This is just like a prior owner, right? So this is what's tricky, is where is the, and James, you can help us with this. Where is it that those words are in the signs? Is that in the deed that is going to go from Steinlauf to Cole?
This is the title.
Yeah. What does it mean? You have experience with this, but other people don't. So what does it mean to do a title search? What are you getting?
Rights to the home.
Like, yeah, but what are the documents? What, in the actual title search itself, what's the type of thing that you're looking at?
Like the history of ownership.
History of ownership. You've got the transfers that have happened throughout the process and all the earlier deeds. So one of the things that could happen is that you might have the deed that the person's handing you looks quite good. It says, like, you know, it says you get fee simple absolute. But they can only transfer to you whatever property right they have. And if they didn't have a fee simple absolute, they can't give you a fee simple absolute. So we actually have to do a title search to go back in time and make sure all of the previous titles, all of those previous pieces of paper and transfers were done correctly. Does that make sense? And so the problem we have is some earlier transfer of whoever Steinlauf, I think I just said prior possessor, whoever Steinlauf got his property from. That's where there was a flaw. So Steinlauf got, so what does he have then? If we think it's a life estate, Sam, you identified it as a life estate. Who, a life estate in whose life?
For, if it was the first, it would have been for Steinlauf's life if it was for the previous son. So both from the 1945 seller to Steinlauf, and then both to assignee instead of to his heirs. It would have been Steinlauf was the first estate. Estate for his lifetime.
Yeah, so I think that's right. What's confusing to us is exactly which title, which deed it was in. So if it's in this deed, if it's in this one transferring to these two, and it's unclear, the life estate is just all that Steinlauf had was the right to own the the right to have the property while he was alive. Doesn't mean he can't sell it, as we'll get to life estate in a second. He could sell his property to Cole, but all Cole would have was that property for however long Steinlauf was alive. What is unclear to me from this case is that whether it was, this is the, it says mezzanine conveyances in here, right? Everybody's like, I glanced over that word because I didn't know it. Was, right? Nobody stopped and looked that up? Mezzanine conveyances just means that there was a series of them. Several conveyances back and forth. So I'm not exactly sure where that errors and assigns is from. It just says it's in one of the prior deeds. So it could be a life estate for the life of somebody who we're not even sure who they are anymore. It could be the life estate for somebody who died a long time ago. What do you think? What do you think Steinlauf should do now? Steinlauf is not, the sale to Cole is not going through. Steinlauf now has property with this weird kind of cloudy title on it. Nate,
bring a quiet title action.
Bring a quiet title action, absolutely. And maybe he can, maybe they'll just clear it up. Maybe whoever had the prior deed will just acknowledge that it was just a like they didn't mean to mean anything by that phrase, and it just gets. Maybe he can show adverse possession, right? If he's had this property long enough. But I think what the next step now is for Steinlauf to file a quiet title action that we learned about with adverse possession. And then, once he has full title, maybe then he can try and get Cole or somebody to buy it again. Is there a hand? No. Okay, so the words of purchase in this case, the words of limitation in this case were weird words. They were to the assigns. And we couldn't quite figure out what to do with that. One of the things that we just talked about with the gift causa mortis applies in these cases as well, which is that one of the things that public policy courts are always trying to fulfill is the intent of the grantor. Right? We're always actually trying to look at what do they really intend to convey. And this can be messy if they don't use the magic words, right? If they haven't used their magic words, then we're not exactly sure what they intended to convey. We have courts who have differing desires or inclinations, I should say, to look beyond the four corners of the document and think about other pieces of evidence that might show their inclination. But here we can say the court says... that this wasn't clear. I think the court is very sympathetic with the fact that it believes that Steinlock can easily go get this deed remedy, right? Otherwise, we might see something else. Okay. I think if this were decided today, I think how do you think a court would interpret this conveyance? Sam?
This had the case book 4 years later that actually changed the law. So I think if it was decided today, it would have just been a fine purchase.
Absolutely, right? I think almost every state now that requiring kind of these like really specific words and invalidating a deed for their usage seems kind of against public policy and cumbersome and unnecessary. What did this force him to do? This forced Steinlock to do a quiet title action. Right? So it just added money and time and paperwork and transaction costs. And I think courts today said, we all know what was intended here. Why require all this investment of time and energy to kind of fix a typo? It's not in the best interest of judicial efficiency or public policy.
Today, what they would do is like the title insurance company would ask for fee simple insurance. So if it was a small defect, they would kind of say, there's a problem here, we don't really trust it, so you're going to have to pay a certain percentage of the value of the property as insurance on the title. So they would avoid going to court. They would close that day, they would have an extra.
But it doesn't actually fix the title?
It kind of does.
It just
accepts it. It's not a huge defect. You see what's going on. But if you face insurance, we'll
But then what happens the next time they have to somebody conveys the land? You have to pay fee simple insurance again or whatever?
It would fix it for the future because they would see in the record that they have.
Interesting. This is not a... So it's good to have all you real estate people in here. This is like, I've never heard of that before. I saw that... Hira?
What just surprised me about this case was just the amount of money in question that they were trying to get back. It just seems like insignificant. To sue on that appeal.
But it's not the $425 that they're trying to get. He's trying to get the price of the house. So the contract between the two said, I will buy your house from you if the title is cleared. And now the buyer wants to back out. I mean, obviously, if this is actually just a really desirable house in a great market, this guy's just going to like be fine and sell it to the next person. He must not have anybody else really offering to buy his house right now. So it's not $425 that's really a dispute. It's whatever the price of this home is, which I don't know if it says. Does that make sense? There's often more kind of backstory here than we realize. Yeah? Okay, let's do life estate. Oh, yeah, okay, just in case. This is my desire to give you guys rules. Would you, everybody already has this in their note, right? Notes without me putting that on a slide? I think so, right? The common law rule is that you needed the magic word. The modern rule is you don't need those magic words. Nemo dat. This is a phrase of nemo dat quod non habet, or something. Yeah, like I said, Latin's not my strong point. This is a phrase meaning that there's only a limited number of property rights out there, and you can only actually convey the property right you have. So it's like a fancy Latin phrase that you might say somewhere that really meant if Steinlock only had a life estate, he could only convey a life estate. We can't kind of make up some new property. New type of estate and let him convey that. He only can convey what he has. But life estate. Let's look at life estates. Now, we've already seen life estates here and there. We've seen, we saw a discussion of it in the Gruen case, for example, right? In some way, we described the Victor Gruen, the dad who owned the Klimt painting, as having a life estate in the painting. We've seen a few other places. All right, this is a current possessory estate, right? You have this at the moment. You own a life estate. You are the one who is possessing the property, but it only lasts as long as a life. Usually, it's for the life to span of the person who owns it. Sometimes it could be for the length of somebody else's life. What we call the person who holds the life estate is the life tenant. When you have it for somebody else's life, we call that a life estate per otra vie. This is not usually because a conveyance says that. It could be. It could be like, I'll give you my property as long as your kids are alive. right? So then you would have a life estate, but the life, the measuring life that's measuring how long you own the property is your children. It's not your own life. It most often happens when somebody has a life estate and then they convey their life estate to somebody. So I give you a life estate and a piece of property, but you don't really want to live there, so you sell that to somebody else. They only have that property for as long as you are alive. They have a life estate per oath for me, and your life is the measuring life. Does that make sense?
Like I said, the terminology can be complicated, but I think actually it's not that complicated of an area. The language that we look to establish a life estate is also very straightforward. From O to A for life. Right? Our words of purchase are to A, and our words of limitation are for life. Maybe they are for as long as you shall live. Now notice, with the fee simple absolute, there was no future interest. The person who had the fee simple absolute owns both the present possessory interest and the future interest. They have the whole shebang. With a life estate, there's always a future interest. Right? There's always a place that property has to go after you die. So the life estate, we say, you can just use these words as place markers for the future interest, and we'll talk about them in more detail next class. But what we call O's interest is a reversionary interest. It makes sense, right? It's reverting back to the owner. Now this means that O and A both currently have property interests. Before O had nothing, he gave everything up. Now O has a reversionary interest. A has life estate. You can ignore the one about the remainder. We'll talk about the reversions and remainders next time. All right, we did that. Right, words of purchase, words of limitation. Two types of... Okay, let's talk about White v. Brown. And I think this might be our last one. Arthur, can you help us with this one?
Yeah. So this is my... She died. She let me know for a holographic will.
What's a holographic will?
I guess writing it in a letter.
It's just handwritten. Holographic just means written by hand.
She said she left her personal property to Miss Perry, but she left her house to live in, only to live in, to Miss White, and it wasn't, and not to be sold.
Right, okay, so this is what we care about, is the transfer of the house. And this is the phrase, this is what it looks like. This is what she said. I, Jesse Lye, being in sound mind, declare this to be my last will and testament. Blah, blah, blah. I wish Evelyn White to have my home and to live in it and not to be sold. And then later on she adds this sentence too. My house is not to be sold. Alright. So now, Arthur, we have to try and figure out what did she convey here. And this is where we get these. This is where we have to deal with these. We deal with it was like people with messy wills. Holographic wills written by hand by people are more likely to not have the right phrases exactly, right? Okay, so what type of estate does Evelyn have?
Oh, she has a...
Right, okay, so this is what we have to figure out. She's arguing. What does she argue that she has? So if you were Evelyn White, what would you want to argue that you have? What's the strongest way to own your property?
The fee simple.
She wants it to be a fee simple absolute, right? That is going to be for the strongest property rights. Fee simple absolute is what she wants it to be. That gives her total power over conveying it and all this type of stuff. Jesse's heirs, maybe they're her devices. I can't remember if she had a will or not. But she's got this one. The residual of her. I think this is all she writes. Right? This is her entire will. It does not include actually everything she owns. So the rest of her stuff is going to be, in theory, this is what her heirs are arguing, that they just said all she got was a life estate, all Evelyn gets is a life estate, and they actually have they'll actually get the property when the life estate is done. They have a remainder interest, it's called. Okay, so this is the two parties disputing whether or not we should interpret this language as a life estate or a fee simple absolute. Do we have any of our magic words in here? Do we have any of our words of limitation?
would have identified to us as a feasible absolute, we wouldn't have had a big dispute here. If we had the phrase, to Evelyn for life, that would have been nice, clear words of limitation. It would have told us it's a life estate. What we haven't said are messy phrases, and we can't figure out whether she's intending this to be a life estate or fee simple absolute. What's your assessment, Arthur?
What do I think?
Yeah, what do you think? If you were to read this...
I mean, just, I think that she, Miss Lott gave Lott's husband to live in that house until she dies.
So you would...
Just a, like a living estate for her.
You read that as a life estate.
Yeah, life estate.
What do you think? Do most of you guys agree that her intention appears to be a life estate? Another option is that she intends to give her house, but she's just expressing her wishes for what Jesse does with the house. Tim?
I think romantically she's saying she doesn't want Evelyn to be sold. I mean, really, I think that's what she said. She wants Evelyn to have the house and to live in it and not to be sold.
Although we do have this, and also her house is not to be sold.
Right. So, that's Evelyn's going to be. Once she dies, it's Evelyn's. So her house will never be sold because Evelyn can sell it, and it would not be her house. It would not be Jesse's house.
So, I mean, this points out to us, like, people write messy things. Like, grammatically, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. Right? And we have to interpret it. What is the best interpretation here? I think our two possibilities are that she intended it to be a life estate, or the other possibility is that she intended her to have her house, intended it to be hers and be simple, but she's expressing her desires for what Evelyn does with the house. Does that make sense? You see how those are two different things? And both of them are potential readings of this phrase. Ian?
So it's unclear to me with a life estate. So, so Mrs. Lye, she has fee simple.
Right? She's a fee simple absolute. She can convey whatever she wants.
So then when, let's say it is a life estate, when that other person dies, like the ownership is then goes back to Mrs. Lye, and then the normal rules follow from there.
Right. Okay. If you have a fee simple absolute that lasts forever and ever, right, you can carve that up. So Jesse Lye owns this whole thing. She can carve this up. You can convey less than you have. You can never convey more than you have. So you can carve that up into be a life estate that you give to Evelyn. And then you have the rest of this. Usually a life estate goes back to O. O has a reversionary interest. It reverts back to her. Because it's a fee simple, the underlying thing is a forever line. Even if O dies, it goes to O's heirs. So going back to O doesn't mean it actually has to go back to Jesse Lye. It goes back to the estate of her, so it goes back to her heir. Which is why her heirs are saying it's a life estate. Because they want to get it when Evelyn dies. What they actually really want to do is sell it right now and divide the proceeds. If Evelyn has a fee simple absolute, she has control. Nate?
I think if it didn't have the, have, it would be more clear that it was a life estate, just the way people talk. So, yeah, I want you to have my whole involvement. Like, that's how people talk about things. And if she were, like, a lawyer, maybe, like, having the word live in there might make people think life, but...
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really confusing. This is where we might want to look at our presumptions, right? Because this is messy, and we can see both interpretations. So if now we have a presumption in favor of a fee simple absolute, then it looks like a fee simple absolute because we can interpret it either way. Now, a fee simple absolute, you could have desires kind of put on the property for what people do with them. You can't actually tell somebody, and this is part of the, at the end of it, you can't, public policy says we can't have total restraints on alienation, though. We're not going to let somebody say in your will, you can never sell it. So we're actually going to read this as a fee simple absolute, kind of cross out that sentence that says it's not to be sold. Evelyn gets to decide that. She gets the full property here. Last question, then.
So it wouldn't be a feasible.
It's not a feasible defeasible. We'll get to those next time because this is against the way the limitations. We allow people to put limitations on property, but not any type of limitation. There's some limitations we think are just against public policy and inappropriate. So this would be one of those. We'll start with that next time.